And so I think what starts to happen is that these exponential technologies change the relative balance of power between what can be done in a city and locally and its need to depend on, you know, hundreds of square miles of farmland or extended food supply chains in order to feed and power itself. And that, I think, starts to change the balance once again between cities and the countryside.
Welcome to The Infinite Block, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of innovative technologies and policies on cities. I'm your host, Oliver Bruce, an angel investor based in Wellington, New Zealand, and I'm excited to have you here.
Hey team, Oliver here. Excited to bring Azeem Azar to you this week. Azeem writes the Exponential View newsletter and hosts the podcast of the same name. He is also the author of the book Exponential, or The Exponential Age, if you live in the US, which we reference a fair amount on this episode. The newsletter is phenomenal and talks about the intersection of tech, politics, climate change, cities, and crypto, i.e. one that I would highly recommend you check out if you are interested in the topics that we talk about here on The Infinite Block. If you are one of those 200,000 subscribers who may have discovered this podcast via the newsletter, I welcome you. I hope that you enjoy this conversation. You may also hear Azeem has recently interviewed Horace Dedu, my co-host for the show, on his work on micromobility recently, and I'd encourage you to go check out that episode if you're interested in our section on micromobility and want to go deeper. In terms of background, Azeem originally started out of uni as a journalist for The Guardian and The Economist before getting into tech, building some of the first websites for media companies, doing a stint at Routers as their head of innovation, founding Peer Index, which was acquired in 2014, and doing a ton of board advisory work and angel investing along the way. I loved this interview. I've been incredibly excited to get to pick his brain given his interests, and I'm aware that it starts out a little bit conceptual, but I do promise we do get down to earth as we progress, and I'm really enjoying the process of exploring these topics and hope that you do too. I feel like they are important questions of our age, and I want to take my hat off to Azeem for really leading the charge as we explore these concepts and questions. And with that, here is Azeem. Hey Azeem, thank you so much for coming and joining us here on The Infinite Block. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Oh, it's my pleasure as well. Thank you, Oliver.
Yeah. Well, look, I do really want to kind of start off this conversation because we at The Infinite Block we're sorting out really what we're talking through and kind of exploring. And it came out of our, you know, we started with the micromobility podcast and we were having these conversations that really were kind of ended up being wider conversations about technology and regulation and cities and how do all of these things come together. And it's very interesting because, you know, I've been looking around for people who were also asking those questions. And, you know, I'd heard some of your earlier stuff, but then I hadn't read your book. And I am so excited to have finally had a chance to read your book. And just to see, you know, that there's somebody else who's really talking about this. You know, I love the idea of the exponential gap. So I thought maybe we'd start there. And then what we can do is we'll just sort of take it off into many different directions. I know you oftentimes are the one doing the interviewings with others. So I'm looking forward to having a chance to letting you run a little on the stuff that you find exciting.
I'm quite relieved to be able to do that. Yeah, no. That's nice. Thank you.
Yeah, not at all. Well, yeah, so take us through exponential gap and why you found that interesting and as an interesting question.
Yeah, so, you know, the book, which is called The Exponential Age in the US and Exponential in Other Parts of the World, really tackles the two sides of the kind of current phase of technology development. The first side is that it's happening really, really rapidly. And I know that you've had Horace Dedu on your show before. And of course, I look at some of Horace's work where he has seen technologies over the last 200 years and seen how quickly they penetrate economies. And of course, what you see is it gets faster and faster and we get deliver more and more technologies. It took less time for TikTok to spread to, you know, 50% of Americans than it did for running water to spread to 50% of Americans. And so that idea of there being an acceleration in technology, it was one that was worth exploring. And what I wanted to do was really dig below the surface to say, is this really happening and why is it happening? And, you know, I think in the first sort of half of the book that I sort of show that. But then the interesting question is, what are the second and third order effects of technology? You know, technologies, A, don't just appear from anywhere. They are bound up in sort of social arrangements and sort of incentives and power structures. And B, when they turn up, they are by their nature disruptive, because what a technology does is it reduces, and I just want to clarify something. When I say disruptive, I mean unsettling. I don't mean disruptive in the Clayton Christensen sense. When a technology shows up, it unsettles a status quo. And we understand that because technologies make certain things cheaper, and so they enable us to do things that we weren't previously doing. And that is a change of a type that any organization sees. The question is, what happens when that change is really, really fast? So we were able to adjust to technologies previously over the period of generations. So a technology might show up and, you know, it might take 100 years to spread across your country or your land or to a neighboring country. That was certainly the case of the printing press. And that allows there to be a process of adjustment. And even at that slow pace, the printing press really, really, you know, turned many European societies inside out. In today's world, the challenge is that for a variety of reasons, we are developing these technologies much more quickly, or they are developing much more quickly, as a question of, you know, who's really doing the developing there.
Mm.
And they are finding their way into our economies and societies much more rapidly, and quite often in quite a decentralized way. And so that creates these new behaviors, these new organizations, these new collaborations and collectives, which may not adhere to the norms and the institutions that we had previously lived with. So for example, you know, when I started my career, I was a traditional newspaper journalist in 1994. There were fewer than 10 million people on the internet. And, you know, my newspaper, which I put online, was one of the first, whatever, 10 or 20 in the world to go online. The internet had not caused us to rethink what it was to be a publisher, or what it was for there to be people producing information that didn't go through the professional process of the news, that allowed people to produce information without having to climb the greasy pole of getting into a media organization. I mean, I think you're talking from Australia and you very much understand the problems of media concentration in that part of the world. And yet, within about 20 years, which is a really short period of time when you think about societal development, virtually none of our questions of media sit around the old style media like newspapers and TV stations. They all sit on this new thing that we still don't have the correct words for, right? Are social media operators publishers? Are they platforms? Are they responsible for the content? Are they not responsible for the content? And what happens just to kind of the fundamental epistemologies that can exist on a network-based platform, which was never really a question when you only had three TV channels and five newspapers.
Totally.
So that is an example of the exponential gap, right? The race of this technology in our the speed with which we can adjust our priors around how these things need to operate in our daily lives.
Yeah. I love the framing of it that you had originally, which you're dealing with linear institutions such as government and their ability to be able to respond, and that you've got those rapidly, you know, those rapidly changing technology patterns. I mean, at its core, that's what Horace was doing when he was looking at the rise of technologies and their technology adoption curves. And I'll link to those in the show notes as well for folks who are interested in checking that out. And it is in your book. And I was very chuffed to see that was the case. Horace has been very integral in this podcast. But at its core, I mean, this is the part that Horace and I end up talking a lot about is it feels like the social contract over time, you know, between a governed and a governing body, it's being renegotiated. And it's obviously happening at a time when governments are, you know, obviously things are starting to accelerate and they're therefore trying to do it and trying to renegotiate it. It's a very challenging time for them because they're not necessarily able to adapt and change on the fly. I mean, one of the things that I didn't see a heap in the book is, where do you foresee the future of government ends up being compared to today? Like, if you were to go widespread, what are the sort of overarching trends of things that you see in terms of how it will change the nature of government responding to, yes, questions of media, but also the other exponential technologies that you've seen?
It's a really big question. And so it is one which I hint at rather than try to answer in the book. And the reason is just that, you know, books have got to be a certain length and authors have only got so much stamina. So
yes,
that can often be a gating factor. You know, I think what you can point to are some critical challenges. And many of them are ones that have been identified by sociologists in years earlier, right? The idea that government is too small to tackle the biggest problems and too big to address the smallest problems being a common one. So, for example, in most countries, most power resides with a national government, and national governments are not that useful when it comes to tackling global collective problems like climate change being a significant one, but the risk of pandemics, or how do we govern the commons? How do we govern the commons that is space, and so on. And then on the other hand, most of us actually don't live at the level of the nation state. We actually live at the level not even of the city, but of our set of neighborhoods or community or town. And that's really where we, our experience with public life occurs. You have this tension, and certainly it's been a tension that has existed and commented on since nation states became the dominant default organizing principle of modern societies, which really has been in the last sort of 100 years accelerated by the process of decolonialization, you know, after the Second World War. And so I think one of the things that I identify is the nature of those particular fault line. And in particular, there are a couple of chapters that look at them at different ends. I mean, think about the macro scale fault line. So the obvious one is climate change, right? And how do you address climate change? The second one is actually, how do you address global technology? So in the exponential age, which is this period of economic development or socioeconomic development that I say sort of started at some point between 2010 and 2015, virtually everything that we deal with is going to be mediated through a set of essentially digital technologies, right? Whether it is payments or access to healthcare or access to information, or as we, you know, plug into VR, even access to realities. And so those technologies are going to cut across national borders and raise questions of their governance. And the way that internet technologies had been governed had been through this theoretically grassroots, but largely US-framed set of organizations. And the way technologies before that had been governed had been through sort of standards bodies like the ITU and so on. And those things were often proxied via national interests, but actually in the internet space, there's a lot more peer-to-peer discussion between commercial providers. And I think one of the challenges for technology governance at the macro scale is that for this to work and for this to give us benefits and for this to be interoperable, there needs to be some kind of pan-regional, ideally global standard. And that is an example where the nation state has to take a different role to the one that it previously had taken. And then, you know, we can talk about the other end, which is what happens at the sort of city level, which is that, you know, it's a different, you know, it's a different dynamic, different question, but it is a super interesting one as well.
Oh, and that is actually really kind of the topic that I think we were examining as we kind of explore this area, the things that are happening at the global level, but really it comes down to how do cities function? Because it still, to me, feels like the city is going to be the organizing principle around a lot of things. People are still attracted to cities, at least for the foreseeable future. Maybe that changes when we get into metaverses and people go and plug themselves into the metaverse and they don't think about where they live. But for the most part, people still are attracted to, you know, the city, the place that they want to be. You know, there have been a number of kind of theories put forward around this idea of maybe we're going to be, as you say, the challenge between, for example, nation states and large bodies and smaller bodies, etc. I am kind of curious as like, do you believe, I assume you're familiar with Nassim Taleb and his thesis that city states are going to be the default organizing principle because they maintain enough flexibility to be able to adapt to technologies and at the same time they're like a functioning size of, you know, a city state can be still a livable and local kind of sufficiently balanced between those two. Do you think that we end up defaulting to something like that with the rise of, you know, increasingly city states?
I don't see many city states in any sort of significant power structures at all, right? Apart from maybe, you know, Singapore, but how important in reality is Singapore? I think there's a natural appeal to the idea that, you know, the nation state was a sort of a political organization whose time is past. And I think it's a really complicated picture. I mean, in some sense, nations are essentially cities because it's their biggest cities that drive all of the innovation and creativity and GDP. But as part of the political settlement, people in cities, for all of their lower carbon usage per dollar generated and increase in the number of patents and books and novels they produce, get less voting power than people who don't live in cities. And that's the case in the United Kingdom. It's true in the US as well. And So there is this sort of complicated balance, and a sort of a trade-off has been made, and, you know, really showed up in the votes in a number of countries, whether it was Austria or Turkey or the UK or the US, in that period, 2014, 2017, 18, where essentially the country voters voted for radical leaders. In the case in the UK, it was about the Brexit vote, and in the US, it was that, oh my God, I forgot his name, thankfully. Donald Trump, pardon me.
I wish we could forget his name.
Yeah. Second it. The name blanked me. So I think that there's a really complicated picture, but what do we know? We know that people are moving into cities. We are past the 50% of humanity living in cities. They continue to move into cities. That means the story of the city, being the crucible of creation and creativity and innovation and wealth, is also true. That the cities are dirty, noisy, polluted places with crime is also true. That cities provide the serendipity that is required in knowledge economies for people to do useful things. So all of that points to the increasing importance of cities. But there's another thing that's really important, which is that this new set of technologies that we have allow us to solve problems that we'd had to solve at a national or international level, at a local level, at a city level. So if you think about what is it to build an electrical power plant 10 years ago, you needed $3 to $5 billion, and you'd create something that would produce, you know, 500 megawatt output. Right. And that was a national scale natural gas power station or a small nuclear station. And you would pump it into a one-way national grid, and it would be regulated at a nation state level. And the thing was so huge, it would probably be shoved off by the coast quite far away. In the world of wind turbines and solar, you have many, many more choices. You know, your solar can be run on rooftops, community levels, utility levels, grid scale levels, and you can put battery storage or different types of storage near a city. So for the first time, you can start to deliver city or community scale energy to cities or communities. And so then that starts to shift questions of where should the power to regulate those things be. You know, you started to see this battle playing out in South Africa, where in Cape Town they have tons of wind power and other renewables, and South Africa suffers from brownouts, but Eskom, which is a national power provider, kind of controls things nationally. And, you know, you have the city going, but we can just keep the lights on for our residents, and you get this tension emerging. And where power goes, so too will other things go. So high-intensity urban vertical farms, which use a combination of high-end agronomy and genetics and robotics and precision lighting and aeroponics, can start to produce much of the food that city residents want without needing to have 4 or 5 day supply chains to bring tomatoes in from another country, which is what happens in the UK. And the arrival of lab-grown meats, which are still sort of many years away, allows you to sort of create your protein, again, closer to the customer. And so I think what starts to happen is that these exponential technologies change the relative balance of power between what can be done in a city and locally, and its need to depend on, you know, hundreds of square miles of farmland or extended food supply chains in order to feed and power itself. And that, I think, starts to change the balance once again between cities and the countryside. And then, you know, finally, you have this question about where should democracy lie? And, you know, I think there is going to be an increasing tension between simply allowing a declining countryside to have more and more political power. How this plays out is really complicated, right? In the US, because city mayors have more power than they have in the UK, you have mayors like Suarez in Miami, who is able to start to set the agenda for the commercial, industrial, and to some extent financial and cultural development of that city, which he has done with this kind of pro-innovation, pro-cryptocurrency stance. And so I think that this is a really interesting battle. I'm not sure you can go as far as say city-states of the future and nation-states will disappear, because these things tend to be more resilient. They tend to take time. They tend to adapt, however slowly. But I think it would make sense for more power and political capability to move towards city mayors. But again, you know, whether central national governments are willing to give that up is a sort of political question, not a technological one.
Yeah. Oh, there is so much amazing stuff in there to unpack. I think the kind of No, this is so good. Yeah, my mind's frothing. One, I loved your part in the book where you talked about the power differential of locales when all of a sudden you have distributed power generation and all of a sudden it goes from like kind of a 4-to-1 differential between like Norway and the Middle East in terms of its ability to be able to generate
right.
solar power, but a 1,000,000-to-1 differential if you don't have oil under the ground versus being able to generate power in other places. And that really does level out the world.
It does. And can I just come in on this point? I mean, I think, you know, if you think about a situation in Ukraine at the moment, and what the Russians are trying to do is they are trying to knock out major power stations, right? And surround them and cut off power to choke cities. Now, interestingly, the Ukrainian internet is still largely standing, although in some places it's been chopped. And one of the reasons for that is that the Ukrainian internet is incredibly distributed. First of all, it doesn't have market dominance in end user internet access. So it's not like the United Kingdom or some other markets where the top three players have 80% of end user internet connections. But the second is that the backbone is very distributed. So in the UK, for example, we have 8 network exchange points where internet service providers exchange data, run by 3 or 4 companies, but the vast bulk goes through a single point in London called the Lynx. In Ukraine, there are 19 of these exchange points in a smaller internet, and they have a much more distributed share of traffic, and that means that traffic routes more resiliently. And so the internet has stayed up largely in Ukraine. And the same thing would be true if countries had more renewable power, because a renewable power grid, base grid, is a two-way grid. It's not a one-way grid, because you have to move the power around more obviously. You have to use storage. You'll have power stored in vehicles, which will be feeding domestic homes and their neighbors' homes as well. And a power grid like that is resilient to a kind of industrial age pummeling, because there's no single power station that supplies 10% of the country's power that can be siloed off. I think it's quite important to see why that's interesting. And it's important to see why that's a challenge to centralized government. I don't know if you're in South Australia, but you know, my experience of Australia, understanding of Australia, is it's not from a government perspective had the most forward-looking policies towards renewables.
Yeah. I'm in New Zealand, but the Aussies. But it is the Australians are like, we laugh at the Australians because they change a prime minister every 6 months, and you know it's like a disaster from a federal government's perspective.
Right. Well, so in South Australia, of course, power is dramatically moving towards solar power, and because individuals are saying, "Well, this makes sense for me. I'm just going to pop some panels on my roof," and apparently it's sunny in Australia. I'm in the UK. I don't really know what sun is. And you can do an end run around a sort of a recidivist energy policy because of these technologies which have declining price in their favor.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a good concept. In some ways, I want to go back to a point that you were talking about just before, where you talked about the balance between really the city and the countryside, and the fact that, like, as we have it set up in our current governance systems, by nature of a kind of a hangover of how voting used to happen, you know, kind of the far out, well, you even just need to look at the Senate. I mean, you literally 2 senators per state, regardless of their populations. I mean, in my last interview, I interviewed Bradley Tusk, who was one of the original kind of political operatives at Uber, but he's now been supporting something called the Voting Project, or Open Source Election Technology, OSET. And he's talking about being able to build technology that would allow governments to feel comfortable with people voting on their mobile phone. It gave way to a conversation about, well, do we end up moving in more and more towards technologies like that, that actually end up building the social technology required to maintain social contract over time. In other words, by allowing more of people to have more of a say at more times, that actually we can maintain that social contract over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think active participation is really, really helpful for getting people engaged. And there are, you know, a couple of examples of sort of adjustments to the democratic process that are interesting. So in Taiwan, which, you know, is kind of unique because of its circumstances, their digital minister, Audrey Tang, was a sort of amazing hacker. And in Taiwan, they have a set of digital products that allow voters to identify and engage with issues on an ongoing basis, which is a really useful temperature check for anyone who's in power. But there are other things that are going on that are perhaps a little bit less technological. One is the approach of deliberative democracy. So we think about where democracy sits today compared to where these systems evolved, which was a small number of representatives, and you then have these political parties, and the political parties aggregate power and in some sense set the agenda. They set the frame of things that can be spoken about in politics, because unless you get a party behind it, it's not going to be spoken about. You know, that happened at a point where there was much less information and there was much less expertise in the world, right? People were less well-educated and they had less good access to sort of ideas. And we've moved on beyond that. But the system is in place and it's kind of hard to shift. As any American listener knows, you can be frustrated about either of your parties, but coming up with a solution to changing that is really hard. You could be Andrew Yang,
you know. Yeah, go found your own forward party.
Who is still not president and, you know, guest on my podcast, unlikely to be president, you know, at any point. So deliberative democracy is pretty interesting, because what you do there is you sort of go out and say, look, citizens understand issues if you give them time. So you allow a citizen's jury to come together over 3 to 4 days, and they get presented with evidence and arguments from academics and experts of other types. And through a directed process, they're able to flesh out the parameters of a particular issue. And that outcome can then be taken to whatever lawmaking body you have, whether it's a referendum or whether it's the legislative body. And citizens' juries and deliberative mechanisms are demonstrated to be able to find more nuanced outcomes and avoid grandstanding on visible but unimportant issues. And there is actually some kind of quantitative peer-reviewed data on that around the Irish abortion referendum. So in Ireland, they had a referendum about the legal status of abortion. It's a Catholic country. It's an incredibly contentious issue. And prior to a national referendum, and referendums can be divisive, I speak as a Brit, the issues were fleshed out through this process of deliberation. And the vote went to liberalise abortion laws in a particular way, with, you know, a lot of comfort, even for people who lost that vote, that the process was a good one and the outcome was sort of acceptable. And it's very different to the UK Brexit referendum, where we did none of that. And we put a simplified and incredibly complex question to a yes, no answer. And we're sort of dissatisfied with the result. So I think that these ideas of deliberation, which are not too dissimilar to what you will see in a open source community or a blockchain project with people arguing about a particular fork or a particular direction, which then goes to a decision point, are really interesting. And so the city of Paris in the last year or two has established a kind of permanent citizens jury, which is a kind of revolving membership thing, I think, to look at and help the sort of legislative body within that and executive body within the city understand issues and understand how to frame the issues and understand what the question that ought to be asked should be. So is that something that can be made more permanent through technology? You know, possibly. I wouldn't necessarily rush to judgment to say put this on everyone's phone, as opposed to the process of sort of jury selection and kind of really thinking through the curation of who presents arguments, you know, one way or another, and how that set of recommendations comes out. I mean, I think that process is really, really important. Once we understand it well, you might be able to come in and say, okay, let's build this in an app. But I wouldn't necessarily start with an app.
No. I mean, I agree with you in the sense that my worry is that we are going to see the rise of online voting apps and things like this. They're going to be kind of very real time, and Kim Kardashian's going to come out and say, like, hey, I'm going to the Oscars tonight. Do I want to wear the red dress or the blue dress? And people will pay to vote and that sort of thing. That's coming. But the thing that will get really crazy is if Donald Trump comes out and says, I want to, you know, invade Ukraine, yes or no, and all of a sudden we're making really, really dumb decisions that we shouldn't be making through populace, in theory, to get the social buy-in, but it's really not, you know?
Yeah, I think that the thing that's really surprising about the process of deliberative democracy is that once informed and given a chance to discuss their ideas, their concerns, their fears and their hopes, citizens are quite often good faith actors who think quite hard about these problems. And they are able to think about them with relevance to their own lives, their own experience, but also in the context of other people's. And so deliberative democracy, I think, has this way of demonstrating that once you give people the tools for agency around political disputation, they can do that well. I mean, you may not agree with what they come up with, but they can do it well. And there appears to be much less hiding place in a citizen's jury or other methods of deliberation for really extreme and absurd ideas, which frankly, cable TV news and social media gives people hiding places. You know, you can just come out with your pithy, annoying aphorism on Twitter, which gets, you know, 8,000 retweets and 12,000 likes. And it's an absurdity, but you happen to be good at putting out that one sentence, and it would never stand up if you had to sit calmly away from a bully pulpit and explain why you thought that and how does that hold together based on what we've heard. And I think that is a really useful process.
Yeah, well, I mean, where I kind of got to after reading your book is like, it feels to me like the technologies are going to continue to get more and more exponential. I mean, this is the nature of this. I'm an angel investor. That's what I do in my day-to-day. I go out and invest in the things that I think are incredibly exciting. But the underlying question that I have around that is just, what are the technologies on the other side that are going to be able to kind of regulate this intelligently? I mean, I came from Uber, where we played that game. We knew we could arbitrage away social trust or play the difference in social trust by building trust in the platform, but not, you know, there was a very slow response from regulators around that because they didn't know. They had to move slowly, and it's fair to say that there was a fair amount of influence on the other side. It wasn't a fair debate, at least initially. But where will those conversations actually happen, and how will they happen? And I do really love that idea. Well, I want to move on a little bit because I was going to get bogged down here. I was surprised, given how interested you are in crypto, because I've listened to you got a lot of podcasts on crypto, and they're like phenomenal for folks who do want to go check those out. But you didn't mention it in the book at all. And, you know, take me on your journey from being, you're writing this in 2019, and now you're clearly in the crypto camp.
I first sold all my Bitcoin in 2015 or 2014, I think. So like many people, I kind of thought, oh, wow, I've made a couple of grand. I should sell it now. I've been looking at this for a while, but I'm not a crypto specialist. I'm a crypto generalist. And part of the choice of not writing crypto into the book as it is because I think I do two things. The first thing is I sort of set up the framework by which you can think about whether a technology has these sort of exponential characteristics, which is that it declines in price by, you know, 10% or more every year on a compounding basis. And so you have that framework and you can apply it to other technologies that you see, and you can then use another framework to figure out what the sort of class of impact is going to be. So that's one important aspect. And then the second aspect is when I talk about the nature of sort of solutions, I point to things to which there are aspects of crypto that could be part of those solutions. So I talk about these three values, right, of commonality and flexibility and resilience as being important design patterns for the exponential age, because ultimately change is happening so rapidly that you need to have systems that are flexible and resilient, but also a lot of new arenas are being developed. And those arenas are either going to be privatized for extraction by private companies on a winner-take-all basis, or they can become commons where we can all operate well. And that's where this idea of commonality comes in. And so when you look at those three values, you can go off and say, well, actually, in many different use cases, blockchain technologies sort of implemented as services espouse those values better than other systems that we might run. So if you think about things like governing data storage, like Filecoin and this sort of IPFS kind of project, it has some sort of commons governance aspects to it. And you can apply those principles to that particular problem and you can say, oh yeah, this sort of fits the model. And then it became an authorial choice about the extent to which I end up writing about crypto projects and crypto as a technology within the exponential age. Since it's not a book that is meant to be an index of technologies, so I don't talk about nuclear fusion. I actually don't talk about protein engineering or cellular agriculture at all in the book. It's just an authorial choice to say, well, what is sufficient to tell the story? And, you know, I felt at that point that it would be complicated for readers to look at a thesis like this that has sort of inputs this very, very distinct style of technology. And if you do, what you end up with is one of those kind of blog posts of like the 20 most radical technologies of the next 10 years.
You did a really good job of not making it that. And I should point out that I did like that element of it. But I'm kind of curious for you, like, has it changed your thesis about how the world might shift, like, as you've got deeper into it over time? I'll give the context, which is when I first kind of came across it.
Across crypto.
Yeah, across crypto. And that was like 2013. And I was reading Ethereum's white paper in 2014 and kind of going like, this feels like a really significant shift, mainly because it's about trust. And it's about this idea of being able to build distributed trust. And when you kind of go back to it, like, that's what a government is. A government is a platform for trust. And over time, I think it's not quite lived up to that yet, but I still think there's obviously potential there. And that's part of what we're trying to explore and unpack here is going, you know, are there places where technology in its traditional form and the sort of traditional, you know, Google and Apple and all the big companies, but actually even the new technologies like crypto specifically, where you can start seeing that the shift away from trust and as part of that renegotiation of the social contract.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting, the most powerful aspect of crypto, of course, is being able to generate collaboration without having to have a sort of trust enforcer. It's an architecture of trust, as a friend of mine, Kevin Werbach, describes it. And that is in of itself really, really powerful. I mean, if we think about what is it that allows us to be smarter than, you know, animals, it's actually about the ability to develop culture, and that culture develops through collaboration. You know, we can pass knowledge from one generation to the next, and we've established that other animals, like whales, for example, the big lovely cetaceans that wallow around in our oceans, have intergenerational culture as well. It's quite rare. And what that culture does is it takes our ability to collaborate, which requires sort of higher order cognitive abilities, and it embeds it across generations. And that allows us to tackle more complex projects that involve a coordination, right? Things that require more than one or two people. And, you know, what's quite interesting is that thousands of years ago, we were able to establish those sorts of processes with the technologies that we had at the time. You know, if you think about maybe even 1,000 years ago, the creation of a cathedral in Europe that might have taken 100 years to build and required stone and stained glass coming from all over the place. The human society had to be able to process those information signals and sort of deliver them with more corruption and leakiness and more slowly than they do today. So technologies that I think help that coordination problem are on a spectrum of approaches that have been kind of process technologies, but also technologies that we have been, you know, very, very used to, and we kind of know what their return ends up being. And I think that that's the really exciting thing about crypto. It's that ability to, in certain domains, enable this kind of collaboration. And, you know, one of my sort of favorite examples, and apologies to anyone who reads my newsletter, because this is kind of my go-to example and has been for a few years, is the Helium network, which is building a low-power wireless network for IoT devices, but it's doing it sort of from the bottom up. So you buy a Helium router, can plug it into your Wi-Fi. When other people's devices connect to it, you earn HNTs, Helium network tokens, which are, you know, tradable for other crypto assets and ultimately into fiat. And we therefore have an incentive to participate in the network. And, you know, people with IoT devices have an incentive to use that as a network provider. And the Helium network has become enormous. But of course, you know, it's far away from being anything like the biggest wireless network in the world, but it, you know, it might get there from this bottom-up approach. And now what's quite interesting is that it's worked so well that in the US, Dish Networks, which is sort of internet service provider, has now done a deal with Helium to say, actually, yes, you've got 300,000 hotspots, but we're happy to offer it as a sort of add-on to our customers as a kind of loyalty and retention mechanism, which is quite interesting because now they're starting to say, hey, we want to be on this. And it's a little bit like when sort of certain kind of hotel or lodging owners started to list their products on Airbnb, because that's totally where the custom was. So I think there are these interesting dynamics. It's about the ability to enable coordination through different mechanisms than the ones we've been used to.
Yeah, we love Helium. We've had them on the Micromobility podcast, and I did one with Horace as well with Amir. Right. Huge fans of them here. And actually, part of the kind of reason that we started exploring the topics that we are in this podcast is because Helium feels to me like a new way of building infrastructure. There's a funding model in there around a speculative use case of something to go and get built, where the only person who's been able to fund that until now has been governments, or like highly, highly regulated monopolies. And where Helium is really interesting is where it says we're going to allow, set the standard effectively, but allow anybody in the world to speculate on the value of the network over time and build mm-hmm. the economic incentives to be able to make that happen.
But I think, we're both fanboys here. I think there's a really interesting question about, you know, proof in theory and proof in, you know, in practice. So we know, for example, the Bitcoin network is incredibly resilient, right? You can, mm-hmm. nations can ban it and the hash rate drops. And then 3 weeks later, the hash rate is back to where it was or above where it was. But the question is, would you trust your partner's heart operation to a process that is governed by crypto, like a DAO? Or would you trust just going to a hospital and saying, here's a doctor, here's a heart yep. surgeon, here's an anesthetist, they're all paid, they've got legal liability.
Totally. So this is a very, very good question. So this is where I think, how do we currently trust those people? So what we do is we say, okay, cool, this person is a certified medical professional. They've clearly done 6 years of medical school and they've done the equivalent of these things, which is probably really good for like 90%, you know, what you want in a medical system. But there are going to be lots of other areas of where we probably could collaborate, where someone, say for example, like I email you out of the blue and I'm like, hey, Izzy, I've got this great idea. I think it's really worth your time to effectively pay attention to me to tell you what this idea is. And mm-hmm. at the moment, we're kind of like slammed with all the stuff that's coming towards us, and you cannot, just because it takes a lot of time to be able to do it, you're not going to go and look at my one and go, okay, cool, Oliver, you know, I have no idea about the infinite block. I have no idea about any of these other things. It's too time intensive and cognitive intensive to go and sort through for the trust. So that part hasn't really been solved yet. But that's where I think something like Numerai has really managed to do that quite well with things like staked information markets. So saying like, mm-hmm. hey, I want to come and talk to you. I've got $1,000 on the line just for you to talk to me. And it's not that you get the $1,000. It's just there's $1,000. And if I'm a moron and totally waste your time, you can burn that money. And so you can mm-hmm. start doing delegation of trust through market incentives rather than necessarily needing to delegate to, for example, a licensing body. I still would want my doctor to be 6 years of medical school and like, you know, have done that. I don't necessarily want it. But there's lots of other areas of the economy where we could open up trust and facilitation. And that's certainly the area where I get really excited, especially for, you know, the work that you do, for example. How do you inform, how do people trust or think about interpreting technology and making sure that, you know, how it's going to be regulated, all that sort of stuff. They come to you because you're a trusted source. They know that you're good. You know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Numerai example is a, you know, really, it's a good example. They do something similar with Ocean Protocol, which sort of allows the sharing of data, and essentially people can predict how valuable a given piece of data is going to be. And if their prediction is accurate, they get rewarded. And what that does is it allows us to get a better market price, right, for data, because you have all this other information. In the same way that you see these in regulated markets, it's like bond rating companies, Moody's and Fitch and S&P do. So that's really, really valuable. And I think there's a lot of places where you could imagine those types of coordination happening. There's the other class as well, which are the other classes, you know, can you build resilient infrastructure like file storage through a market incentivized model? And, you know, that puts Helium and, you know, for bandwidth and Filecoin and storage and so on the same area. And, you know, I think the other one that's quite interesting is whether we can use DAOs as coordination mechanisms that can also, in a way, deploy capital. And there's a sense of higher trust because you understand that the rules by which that capital gets deployed or those resources get deployed are embedded in the actual code, right? So they're kind of non-repudiable in that sense, right? One of the beauties of the internet was that it allowed people to sort of flock together and do things. And good examples of that was Hank the Angry Drunken Dwarf, who was Time Magazine's, ran in 1996, an internet poll including a write-in for who should be Time Magazine Person of the Year. And of course, back in 96 was the first time this had been done, or early times. Everyone wrote in Hank the Angry Drunken Dwarf, and Time, of course, ignored that. Had they done it on a crypto sort of system, of course, they would have had to go with the people's choice at that point. And, you know, things like flash mobs, you know, or more serious things were demonstrations of what these powers of coordination that the internet enabled pre-mobile were. And the fact that we could start to do that through these mechanisms of DAOs around causes that people find interesting, I think is also a really, really important kind of class of uses. And what it does is it actually moves us away from things that are in a way technical but kind of quantitatively measurable. So the example of Numerai, right? Either my model worked or it didn't. Yes. If it didn't work, I don't get rewarded. If it did work, I do get rewarded. And that's quite straightforward. But if you think about should we go off and improve cycle lanes in our village with a bunch of cash that we've collected through a DAO and put an organization together around it? Well, that's a much softer question for which there needs to be a process of discussion, debate, and argumentation, and ultimately a kind of governance mechanic that everyone understands. I think that's quite interesting in itself, this idea that we can go into these slightly squishier areas of decision making as well.
You're talking my language, because I actually wanted to get onto cities if we can. I love crypto. I could talk about it forever, but this is a show about cities as much as it is a show about crypto. And, you know, there's one thing that I know, and you've oftentimes talked to it, which is that cities work best when they foster serendipity and collaboration. And you make the point in your book about the importance of things like chip manufacturing city in Taiwan. There's like, I think it's 40 square kilometers or something, and it's like the entire GDP.
All the chips.
Yeah. They manufacture everything, and it's like the entire GDP of Manhattan, but it's in something that's incredibly small. It's the size of Central Park or something. And I think about it and go, you know, that's built an ecosystem. You get all of these people together, allows them to kind of innovate, get funded, build things of value. And I think about that a lot, especially, you know, when we think about cities. Cities are really, if you go kind of to the Alain Botard, you know, order without design thesis, it's cities are agglomerations of where people go to effectively better their lives. They go there because they want to get jobs. And so the function of a city is to be able to facilitate that to happen. And yet I have not seen, as far as I can find, any research that supports the thesis that a well-designed urban form can develop better outcomes, especially in the exponential age. I feel like it's like the nub of truth. We all know it. You want to live in a walkable city because you want to walk around and run into all your cool people that you can talk about ideas with and all that sort of stuff. Have you seen any research that sort of supports that and that then turns around and informs public design?
There's a reverse sort of approach, which is that people have a travel time budget every day, which they tend to stick to. And your mode of transport then determines how far away you live and what you can then do with that time. And so once you start to work back from that, there is a little bit of research that demonstrates that in the UK, one of the reasons why some cities are relatively poorly developed, Birmingham being an example, is to do with the complexity of commutes within and across the city. And that is the research there is done by a group called ODI North. Tom Forth, who on Twitter, you can look him up. He put this sort of interesting research. And I think that was an example that demonstrated that you could construct this time poverty within a city if you had poor urban design, particularly around how people travel. But I think the other thing to think about is that within Western cities, the issue is really about, ends up being about quality of life, and it ends up being about, you know, the environmental considerations. But where the cities that really matter are the ones in China and India and sub-Saharan Africa, right? These are the ones that are going to get to 100 million people. And when I think about this debate about do cities matter and are people fleeing cities, it might be true that a handful of humanity's richest people, that is the average developer in San Francisco, is moving to Austin or Boulder. They are vastly outweighed by the 150 million Nigerians who will move into cities in the next couple of decades. And so I tend to think about the cities debate as being as much about that and about the mega city as it is about the compartmentalized community city that we're starting to see in richer countries.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time on the micromobility podcast talking about where the rise of the cities will be and why micromobility is interesting. And actually, it hasn't really anything to do with, you know, it's nice to go and retrofit some bike lanes into London, but really it's about being able to move huge numbers of people in countries that aren't necessarily able to go and develop public transport infrastructure at the same speed and scale as, for example, other countries. And so what sort of vehicles will work in those environs and we happen to think it will be small, lightweight electric vehicles, just because that will be make the most sense in those places. And that was obviously the thesis behind Micromobility, the podcast. And I know you had Horace on, and I did listen to the episode. It was great to hear.
Well, he's amazing. But I think one of the things that Horace points out is, you know, the path of this is going to be a typically uneven one, where, you know, Western cities with forward-leaning mayors and sort of small medieval layouts and relatively small footprint cities are likely to develop towards micromobility more quickly. And in the US, the Atlantas and the Houstons will take a really, really long time. I'm curious about what happens in, say, China, where there has been a really clear technocratic top-down push around electrification and autonomous vehicles, and whether they will have a sort of state-mandated approach towards supporting the auto mobility via the autonomous vehicle model rather than the micromobility model. And I think sometimes these things also play into a cultural dynamic, that the move from walking to cycling and then cycling to a car is seen as part of economic development, right? And it's believed culturally, but it's also believed by the economic planning departments within governments. And so the idea that you are leapfrogging by avoiding a car and going to a thing that looks like electric auto rickshaw, it may be a hard sell in some of these countries.
That's true. Yeah, I totally get that too. We've had some China specialists on who made the point that we're maybe barking up the wrong tree, that this is going to be a widespread adoption in China. The counter to that is that people don't adopt it because it's prestigious or anything at all. They adopt it because it is the most convenient way to get around in a highly congested city, which is one that we can kind of foresee being the case for a long period of time. And that the smaller vehicles, and I'm talking about e-bikes, I'm talking sort of like electric pods and, you know, tilting three-wheelers and all that sort of stuff that allow you to lane split, go down between everything and are covered and, you know, have climate control and all that sort of stuff. Those sort of things will be the next generation of vehicles that might... You win because you're just the best in terms of being able to address the job to be done, less the, yeah, maybe not on the prestige thing, but we can come, you know.
But you know, I think one thing that's interesting is that markets like India have had a very different path when it comes to their sort of automotive journey to Western markets. You know, you do see in the last sort of decade or so more of the traditional car marks there. But actually, if you went to India, you'd see a lot of vehicles that you weren't familiar with, because they would be sort of Japanese-Indian crossovers and much smaller engines and sort of smaller form factors than you certainly see in the US. And I wonder whether the desire by the domestic industry to demonstrate its capability, especially as we see this go through this process of deglobalization, will enable the arrival of things that look different. So it's not just that, well, this is a sort of a local luxury car that competes feature by feature to an Audi, for sake of argument. But rather, to use another sort of, you know, management theory, this is a blue ocean car that does not compete in the Western red ocean. And it's a vehicle that is different. It is distinct. It is, you know, it has the kind of national pride baked into it. And it might be a reverse three-wheeler with an enclosure and climate control that seats four people and can travel 50 miles on a single battery charge and cost less than $3,000, right? That might be the kind of thing that one establishes, and you establish a sense of, you know, national or local identity around these brands and their suitability. And I think it's important to take into consideration, you know, that when we look at the jobs to be done framework, which to me is, you know, such a powerful way of thinking, the way that might end up being expressed and how it gets expressed industrially may also be connected to, you know, cultural and political moments. And, you know, the cultural and the political moments is certainly in many parts of the world, it's a kind of awakening after colonization and a desire for some degree of distance and national identity that is not about, first and foremost, being members of the Commonwealth, something as you as a New Zealander understand, alongside the kind of geopolitical reality that if you're dependent on SK Hynix via memory chips and batteries from Korea as well, and you're dependent on, you know, Germany for your machine tools, that stuff can be turned off on a whim if those, that collection of Western oriented nations decide they need to do that. And I think, you know, I think all of this plays to different pathways.
Yeah, I'm incredibly excited to see where we end up with the lightweight electric vehicles, because I think they really democratize vehicle production in ways that we've not seen before. I mean, building an auto industry is so top-down and very heavy. Like, you end up with a huge amount of state support. And what we've seen with micromobility, the reason we think it's so exciting is because it allows the emergence of these makers who are in completely random places around the world to make vehicles and be able to scale them and build some interesting solutions that obviously work for the local market, because it's very modular technology being combined.
Mm.
Hey, well, look, I'm aware we're up against time. I could talk for another hour with you about all this stuff, because there's so much in here. Look, but for folks who are new to you, how would they find you? What's the best way to check you out?
Well, I think the best way is you just go and find Exponential View. You put it in your search engine of choice, DuckDuckGo, Bing, Yandex, maybe even Google, Exponential View, and you will find my newsletter there, and you can sign up. And, you know, the Twitter stuff exists as well. It's just at Azeem, which is A-Z-E-E-M.
Yes, and also as well your podcast, which is fantastic. And like, there are so many phenomenal conversations in there, including with some really wonderful folks like Vaclav Smil, who I think is a total legend, and one that I was really excited to see that you managed to interview, among many, many others. So thank you so much, Azeem. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to hopefully bringing you back on the podcast at some point in the future, and we can talk maybe about some other specific things, questions that come up as we go.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Oliver. Appreciate it.